Benvenuti a tutti a questa nuova puntata della Tana dell'Orco, rubrica curata dalla redazione storica di Liberi Oltre, in cui invitiamo professori a parlare delle loro ricerche e pubblicazioni. E oggi abbiamo l'onore di avere con noi il professor David Bell. Il professor Bell è uno storico del mondo atlantico della prima età moderna, con particolare interesse per la cultura politica dell'illuminismo e della Francia rivoluzionaria. Dal 1990 al 1996 ha insegnato a Yale, dal 96 al 2010 alla Johns Hopkins, per poi entrare nel 2010 alla facoltà di Princeton, dove insegna ancora adesso. È membro dell'American Academy of Arts and Sciences e socio corrispondente della British Academy. Il professore ha pubblicato molteplici ricerche, The Cult of the Nation in France, una biografia di Napoleone, Napoleon, a Concise Biography, ma oggi in particolar modo parliamo di un libro che ha avuto anche la sua edizione italiana, Il culto dei capi, carisma e potere nell'età delle rivoluzioni, che nella sua edizione americana intitolato Man on Horseback. In questo libro il professor Bell analizza un fenomeno che nell'immaginario comune si tende soprattutto a collegare al secolo scorso, ossia il fenomeno del culto e dell'ascesa dei capi politici carismatici, sia quelli autoritari che quelli, diciamo, democratici. Però il professore studia questo fenomeno in un periodo diverso e anzi possiamo dire che va alla radice di questo fenomeno, perché, come lui dimostra, il moderno culto di leader politici carismatici è qualcosa che nasce durante l'età dell'illuminismo e delle rivoluzioni, quindi, per chi si ricorda, diciamo, dalla scuola, un campo cronologico che va dalla seconda metà del Settecento alla prima metà dell'Ottocento. Si tratta di un'epoca che tradizionalmente viene identificata, no, come il momento di ingresso del mondo europeo occidentale nella modernità, un'epoca in cui vediamo l'affermarsi di diritti umani, repubblicanesimo democratico, ma anche un'epoca, come ci dimostra il professor Bell, in cui nasce il moderno culto dei capi, anche autoritario. E il professore analizza la nascita di questo fenomeno tracciando il profilo di 5 importanti leader politici carismatici. So now I switch to English and I will go on with the questions. First of all, the first question I'd like to ask is very general. From a historiographical point of view, why did you decide to write this book and to do this research?
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for the kind introduction. And I'm grateful to have the opportunity to talk about the book today. Why did I decide to write this? I felt that, well, one thing that I felt was that there was definitely a kind of absence in our understanding of the Age of Revolution. So much of the attention to these great revolutions of the Atlantic world in this period really focused on the crowds, on the masses, on the people, which is, of course, extremely important. And there was much less focus on leadership, on the people who really emerged to direct these revolutions and to take control of the countries in question. And that seemed to me, you know, a pity that there hadn't been more, particularly more comparative work on these figures, such as George Washington and such as Simon Bolivar in South America, such as Bonaparte, of course, in France, Toussaint Louverture in Haiti. I think that the study of individuals often causes a problem for historians. Since the heyday of the École des Annales in France in the mid-20th century, there has been always a very strong tendency among historians to really focus on the large numbers of people. This has been reinforced in the Anglo-American world by what is often called history from below, and a rejection of what used to be called the great man theory of history, whereby everything in history depends on the actions of a few great white males. Now, I certainly don't want to go back to the age of the great men. That's not the way I see history in the least. But that said, these figures were incredibly important in the Age of Revolution. And one thing that the focus on the masses, the focus on democracy, tended to occlude is the fact that most of these revolutions, in a very basic sense, failed, that they did not create permanent democratic regimes, but rather, in most cases, the regimes that did emerge, the democratic regimes that did emerge, were quickly overturned by authoritarian rule. This was certainly the case in France, obviously, with Napoleon Bonaparte. It was the case in Haiti with Toussaint Louverture and his successors. It was the case in South America with Bolivar and with the Caudillos who followed him. So I felt that this was really something that needed more attention. And to my astonishment, I found that there had really never been a serious academic work taking the leadership of the Age of Revolutions and comparing these people in a serious way. So I thought that this would make an interesting subject for a book. And finally, I don't want to go on for too long here, but finally, I thought that it would also be very interesting to try to take the notion of charisma, which is a very common notion in the social sciences. And of course, it is also a notion that is, you know, very widely discussed in the culture at large. And I thought it would be interesting to try to actually use it as a serious category of historical analysis, to try to use it as a way of understanding the phenomenon of leadership in this period as something that was really very different from the leadership of monarchs in the regimes that preceded the Age of Revolution. So for all these reasons, I thought it would be an interesting challenge to try to write this book.
Very, very interesting. So the second question is, what are the main common characteristics of these five figures? And can we say, what are the typical characteristics of a charismatic political leader in the age of revolutions? Because I'm asking you this because then I want to focus on some particular individuals of the five that you described.
Sure. So, and this was something, you know, the question of the similarities between these people was something that I was, of course, extremely focused on in the book. At the same time, I should say, I wanted to be very careful not to squeeze them all into the same mold, to say that they're all exactly alike, because they certainly weren't. There are huge differences between them that we can get to later. But certainly the similarities are there. And I think some basic points were that, you know, I think most importantly, they were all genuinely very popular. These are figures who genuinely managed to excite the acclamation of a large portion of the population in the countries where they lived. And this is a really important fact. Why were they able to do this? Well, there are also some similarities there. So some basic similarities, these were all military men. They all come out of military training. They come out of the armies of the period. They are all people who are also seen by their societies as being having remarkable qualities, as being almost a kind of superman, as having exceptional qualities. In some cases, these qualities are actually very physical. George Washington, for instance, being very, very tall, strong, powerful, good-looking. All of these people, you know, were physically impressive. The fact that they were also at least claimed to be extremely good on horseback is really a very important factor as well. We tend to forget today in our era of automobiles and trains and planes just how important it could be in this period to really have the skill to be able to ride a large, powerful horse extremely well. This is something that would be seen as really very impressive. At the same time, they all had what we could call in some ways, or at least they were all able to create a kind of bond with ordinary people. And this is the other side of charisma in the period, which is really very important. They were all able to, people imagined having a personal relationship with them. They imagined having an emotional relationship with them. And there was something about them that allowed them to create this, obviously, in most cases, a fantasy on the part of ordinary people, to imagine that, you know, you could have a conversation with them, that they would have an emotional attachment to you and you to them, and so on and so forth. And there are many, many other things that they had in common. I think the final point that I would make here, and it relates to what I've been saying before, is in modern terms, we would say that they were all celebrities. And here in the book, I was drawing in particular on the work of the French historian Antoine Lilty, who's written a wonderful book on the birth of celebrity culture in the 18th century, trying to show that really what we call celebrities, not only was the word a celebrity as a noun born in the 18th century, but in fact, the phenomenon of modern celebrity, which of course has reached far greater heights in the 20th and 21st century, was already there in the 18th. In particular, people, a public taking very deep interest, not only in these people as public figures, as leaders, but in them as individuals, as them as people, as them as, in a sense, characters in a novel. And one of the important factors that I wanted to, that I tried to stress in the book is that it's no accident that these figure, that celebrity culture emerges and that these people emerge at the moment that the novel as a literary genre takes on such importance in Western culture, because people become accustomed to reading about characters whom they don't know personally. And they saw these political figures through the same lens, which again, you know, particularly they were eager for personal details about these people, for private details, for the private life. As one of the biographers of George Washington, one of the early biographers of George Washington said, you know, all life is essentially private life. If you want to know somebody, you have to know them in their intimate lives and not simply in their public appearances. So in all these ways, these five men had a great deal in common. These were the factors that really allowed them to establish their popularity and allowed them to establish their, in a sense, their political dominance over their countries, even if not all of them actually took advantage of this dominance to seize power as authoritarians.
I would now like to focus on two figures who I assume are less known to the public in Italy. I'm talking about Pasquale Paoli, which is the leader of the Corsican independence. And I think not a lot of people in Italy know Pasquale Paoli, although many, let's say, nationalists say that Corsica should be Italian. And Toussaint Louverture, who I personally think a very complex figure, and that was an important leader of the slave revolt that took place in what we call today Haiti or Santo Domingo. And first of all, regarding Pasquale Paoli, I would like to ask you if you could kindly give a brief introduction to this figure and then explain how he became an important political model and, I would say, really a literary star in the Anglo-Saxon world between the 1760s and 70s, especially in North America.
Sure. So Pasquale Paoli was a Corsican. Perhaps it's not surprising that Italians don't know about him, because despite being Italian essentially in language and in background, he led a movement, a revolution against an Italian country. He was the leader of the revolt of the Isla di Corsica, the island of Corsica, against the Republica of Genoa in the 18th century, and helped establish the independence briefly of Corsica from Genoa. He was himself the son of a very important Corsican political figure. He himself was trained as an army officer in the army of Naples. But then there was a very long revolt and a long war that really begins in the 1720s, in which the Corsicans try to establish their independence from Genoa. And in the 1750s, Paoli, who's now 30 years old, comes back to Corsica and is quickly acclaimed as the generale, as the leader of the Corsican people. And in large part, thanks to his leadership, by the 1750s, Corsica does manage to establish a de facto independence from Genoa. And Paoli then becomes, you know, not only does he become the leader, but he becomes quite famous throughout Europe for many of the reforms that he leads. So he founds the university, he introduces for the first time a printing press to the island of Corsica, he writes what is now seen as a constitution, one of the earliest written constitutions in modern European history, for the island of Corsica. And he impresses people because of his leadership capacities. Now, the question of how he becomes a celebrity through the Anglo-Saxon world is very interesting, because it's above all due to a single person, a man named James Boswell, who is very well known in the Anglo-American world for his biography of the writer Samuel Johnson, one of the first great biographies in the English language. But in the 1760s, particularly in 1765, Boswell is a young, completely unknown Scotsman who is very eager to meet great, great men. So he travels throughout Europe. He meets Jean-Jacques Rousseau in Switzerland. Rousseau at the time has been writing the project for the Constitution of Corsica, in part for Paoli, and he tells Boswell about Paoli and says, if you want to meet a truly great man, you have to go and visit Paoli. So Boswell goes to Corsica. He travels there. It's not easy in this period, but he lands in Corsica. He goes about halfway down from the north of the island down to the southern part of the island. He meets Paoli, and he's immediately completely blown away by Paoli. He falls under the spell of Paoli. He sees how Paoli is able to sort of generate, again, the acclamation, the love, as he says, of ordinary Corsicans. He sees Paoli as this great figure of unity. He sees him as a genius. He sees him as a great figure of enlightenment. I think essentially Boswell falls in love with Paoli. And then he goes back to Britain. He urges the British government to actually support Paoli, something which becomes very, very important a couple of years later when the Genoese finally give up on Corsica and they sell the rights over Corsica to the Kingdom of France. And the French decide, all right, if we're going to take this over, we're going to actually invade Corsica. So the French send in their army, which by 18th century standards is a very large, powerful, professional army, much more effective than the Genoese. They very quickly start to defeat Corsica. Boswell at this time publishes a book, which is essentially about, it's both the history of Corsica, a portrait of Corsica, but also a portrait of Paoli, which is, again, coming back to what I said a moment ago about charisma, it is a very intimate portrait of Paoli. It describes him in physical detail. It gives instances of his sort of private life. It talks about his quirks, his inability to sit still, his enormous memory. It gives many portraits of Paoli talking to ordinary people in Corsica. And the book is an incredible bestseller. It makes Boswell's career in Britain. It inspires an enormous flood of writing about Paoli. It makes Paoli a celebrity in Britain. Paoli starts to publish public letters in Britain in the newspapers in order to try to gain support. There's a rather funny moment when Boswell is trying to actually collect arms for Paoli and even urges the British government to enter the war between Corsica and France on the side of Corsica. And the quartermaster general, who's a member of the British cabinet at the time, says, you know, this is ridiculous. We can't go to war with France just because Mr. Boswell has been to Corsica. Rather funny line. So Boswell's, because of Boswell, Paoli's sort of legend spreads very wide. It spreads to France, it spreads to Germany, it spreads to Italy itself. There's an Italian translation of Boswell's book, which is read by no one else other than the young Napoleon Bonaparte, who is still more comfortable in Italian than in French when he's in school, Napoleone Bonaparte, as he was called at the time. And then, very interestingly, the legend of Paoli particularly takes root in North America, in the British colonies, for the rather obvious reason that this is the moment when the colonies are beginning to start to break loose from Britain, and the story of a small colonial outpost trying to fight off a colonial power is, of course, very of great interest to them. So in all these ways, Paoli becomes this great celebrity figure. Now, what happens, of course, also is that he loses. Because France invades Corsica, Paoli can't possibly hold them off. There's the Battle of Ponte Nuovo. He loses, and he goes off to a very comfortable exile in Britain, where he actually finds Boswell again, brings a lot of money with him, sets up a very large and comfortable townhouse, entertains Boswell and Samuel Johnson, has a very nice life. But his defeat, in a sense, gives him almost a kind of Christ-like, martyr-like aura, which only adds further to his charismatic appeal.
Yeah, and I would have asked you, because Napoleon at the beginning really admires Pasquale Paoli. Can we say that this admiration was in some way also not returned by Paoli?
Definitely not. So this brings us to the history of a little slightly later history. So Paoli is an enormous, you know, is a figure of enormously admired in Corsica, of course. Even the Corsicans who accept French rule, like the Bonaparte family, still sort of worship Paoli from afar. He is seen as the great hero. Boswell's book, which is translated into Italian, does a great deal to push this legend of Paoli. So at the beginning of the French Revolution, the French Revolutionary government gives Corsica a degree of autonomy. And they allow Paoli finally to return from London, where he had been in exile. And at the same time, Napoleon Bonaparte, who was at that time a young artillery officer in France, also goes back to Corsica. And he himself is worshiping Paoli at this point. But what happens is that he and his brother Lucien become very deeply involved in Corsican politics between 1789 and 1793. And quickly they find, first of all, Paoli doesn't really like them very much. He sees them as too ambitious. He sees them as challenging his own authority. He doesn't like them at all. He even sends Napoleon off on a half-baked expedition to invade Sardinia, and he's really probably hoping that Napoleon would just get conveniently killed while doing this. And they also become increasingly opposed politically. Lucien Bonaparte in particular, this is Napoleon's hot-headed younger brother, becomes a very fierce Jacobin, a supporter of Robespierre, whereas Paoli is much more aligned with the faction in France known as the Girondins. And then in the spring of 1793, the Girondins are purged in France. Paoli's position in Corsica becomes very difficult. Lucien Bonaparte tries to denounce Paoli and take power. There's a struggle between the different clans in Corsica. And to cut matters short, the Bonapartes are forced to flee Corsica to go back to France. This is an event with really genuinely world-shaking consequences, because at this point, Napoleon, who had seen his future tied to Corsica, says, forget about Corsica. I don't care about Corsica anymore. I'm going to go and make my career in France. And he goes to the siege of Toulon, and the rest, as they say, is history. But Paoli then at this point actually leads a revolt against revolutionary France, establishes, you know, invites in the British fleet. Corsica establishes a kind of protectorate, the Anglo-Corsican kingdom briefly under British protection, but then they're defeated. Paoli sent back into exile for a second time and dies in exile in the early 19th century in London. So Napoleon Bonaparte therefore has this long, complicated history with Paoli, but it doesn't change the fact that Paoli, that the legend of Paoli remains very important. And the great writer, French writer Stendhal, says that, you know, essentially Napoleon modeled himself entirely after Paoli. I think they're compliments to that.
Thank you. So before moving on to Toussaint Louverture, I would like to ask you a question about a phenomenon that you describe very clearly in the chapter on Paoli. So what was the difference between, I think this is very important, the charisma and promotion of the image of, let's say, the ancien régime kings and emperors, and the charisma and image of modern charismatic political leaders? And how, in some way, does the advent of popular legitimation of political power take place?
That's a very important question. Sometimes the book has been a bit misunderstood by people who say, well, of course, charisma wasn't invented in the 18th century. Lots of people were charismatic before then. Of course, I wasn't trying to say that there was no such thing as charisma before the 18th century. What I was trying to do in the book was to historicize the phenomenon of charisma, to say that charisma can take different forms in different periods and under different political conditions when we're talking about political charisma. And the charisma of monarchs is certainly there, a figure we could certainly call a king like Louis XIV charismatic. We could call somebody like Charles I charismatic of the Holy Roman of Spain and of the Holy Roman Empire. You know, lots of monarchs have this kind of charismatic aura to them. But it's very important to recognize that monarchs, you know, their legitimacy, their fundamental legitimacy comes from, obviously, their position in a dynasty, their inheritance, their right to their legal right to a kingdom, and also from religion, from the notion that in Europe that they are, in some sense, anointed by God to be monarchs. And their charisma is very tightly linked to this, so that the rituals of kingship involve, you know, the assumption of kingship as the heir to one's father. It involves the blessing of the king by religious figures. And it does not necessarily involve the personal qualities of the king himself or the queen herself. And what happens with a figure like Paoli is he's seen as being self-made by himself. Yes, he is the son of an important Corsican leader, but that is ultimately not what gives him his charismatic appeal. It has nothing to do with his father. It has nothing to do, or very little to do with his father. It has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with his own deeply personal qualities, and it has to do with the bond that he has with ordinary people. And again, this is something very different from these monarchs. Now, the monarchs would certainly claim a bond with ordinary people, but in a very hierarchical way, so that it would often be said of European kings that they were the fathers of their people. But what did this mean? It meant that they had the authority of a father over his people, over his children. It would mean that they had a responsibility to care for their people, to tend to them the way a father would tend to his children. But it did not mean that they were in any sense the equal of the people. And with the charismatic leader of the age of democratic revolutions, something very different happened. Somebody like Paoli On the one hand, he's seen as being very special by his personal qualities and therefore distinct from the people. But at the same time, he's able to circulate and to interact with them on an ordinary level. What Boswell paid great attention to in his book about Paoli is to show that Paoli would converse with ordinary Corsicans as an equal, as a democratic equal in a sense. And the same would be true of, you know, of the way that people tried to present George Washington or Bolivar and so on and so forth. So Bonaparte, for instance, you know, there's the famous incident at the Battle of Lodi where he steps in to load a cannon himself because he's a former artillery officer. And after the battle, the cannon crew says to him, "Eh ben, monsieur, you know, you're so good at loading the cannon, you can be our new corporal." And he becomes known as the Le Petit
Corporal,
the Little Corporal. And this is something you cannot imagine happening with the European monarch of the time, of the earlier period. So there's a very great shift in the kind of forms, in the kind of phenomenon of charisma itself as it becomes democratized in this age of revolution. So I think that's how I would make that distinction.
Now, let's talk about Toussaint Louverture, because I said that I personally found it a very complex figure because we see him rising from slavery, serving then in the Spanish army, leading then the slave revolt, becoming governor under Napoleon, and then later being removed by Napoleon. And I think it's a very, apart from historians specializing in the age of revolutions, I think he's also relatively unknown in our country, in Italy, maybe more in the Atlantic world, so France, United States. Could you elaborate on why Toussaint became a model of charismatic leadership for Europe's intellectuals?
Sure. So, as you say, Toussaint Louverture is a very complicated figure. He's, to say a little few more words about his life, he's born sometime in the early 1740s. On the island that is then called the part of the island of Hispaniola, in the part of it that was called by the French Saint-Domingue. We now know it as Haiti. He's born as a slave to parents who were enslaved in Africa. Sometime in the 1770s, he's actually freed. He becomes a free man. He actually tries to establish a plantation himself and actually has enslaved labor himself for a time, but he fails at this and he goes back to the plantation where his wife and children are still enslaved. And then in 1791, in the middle of the French Revolution, this French colony has a revolution of its own. It's a very complicated set of events. But in 1791, there's a massive revolt by enslaved people starting in the north of Saint-Domingue, which very quickly challenges French power. Toussaint Louverture is not initially the major leader of these groups, but he becomes one. At the beginning, this revolt is not a revolt for freedom for all the enslaved people. It is definitely not a revolt for independence. It is a revolt where the people, the leaders, ask for freedom for themselves and their families and for better working conditions for all the rest of the enslaved people. But this is the French Revolution. It's a period of enormous political instability. Also, as of 1793, it's a period of war in which France is fighting Britain and Spain. And if you're looking at the Caribbean Sea, well, you know, the island of Hispaniola is divided between France and Spain. There's also the colony of Santo Domingo, the Spanish colony, which is now the Dominican Republic. And then not too far away, there's the island of Jamaica, which is British. So the war very quickly comes to the Caribbean as well. And it's a multifaceted war involving British, involving Spanish, involving French royalists, involving French revolutionaries, involving different black forces in Saint-Domingue. But the important point here is that Toussaint Louverture is one of the people who takes advantage of this complexity by actually enrolling in the Spanish army, along with some of the other leaders of the slave revolt. He becomes a general. He's given the title of general in the Spanish army. He holds that for about a year. And in order to keep the situation from collapsing entirely, the French commissioners on the island actually decide to take the very fateful step of proclaiming the abolition of slavery in Saint-Domingue. And after they do this, Toussaint Louverture is already establishing his primacy as the most important leader of the black forces. He issues an important proclamation in the summer of 1793, the proclamation of Camp Turel, in which he says that I am now fighting for the freedom of all the enslaved people in Saint-Domingue. And a year later, he has moved over to the French forces to ally with the revolutionaries fighting against the British, against the Spanish, against the French royalists. But he is controlling here an army which represents the by far the largest part of the population. About close to 80% of the population, at least, are enslaved Africans. So he is now leading this, and they very quickly are able to come to victory as a result. And he is such an important figure here, and he's recognized as having such power by the French authorities that he's eventually given the title first lieutenant governor, then he is able to outmaneuver his French rivals and becomes governor. So all of this is, again, very complicated story. I'm sorry for going on for so long about it. No. But in the course of doing all of this, he becomes recognized in the first by the French revolutionaries in Saint-Domingue, but then increasingly by revolutionaries in France, and then by abolitionists and by people favorable to abolition in Britain and the United States. He becomes seen as this remarkable figure. He becomes seen as and they start writing about him in great detail. They start taking the letters. He is himself a very prolific writer. He has the help of French secretaries, but he writes an enormous number of speeches and letters in French. These are republished in France. They are translated and published in London and in Philadelphia and in the United States. And these establish a reputation for him. People go to Saint-Domingue and they meet him. They are very impressed by him. Again, personally, he is an incredibly impressive man. He is an extremely good horseback rider. Again, to come back to that theme, he has, you know, what is seen by these people as having, you know, almost complete control over the black forces, over the forces of the formerly enslaved. And he is able to speak very good French. And he comes off as being incredibly articulate and intelligent to them. Now, there is an element of racism here, because when they describe Toussaint Louverture, they often say, well, he's not like the other blacks. They're all stupid and bestial, they say, in a very racist way, and he is not. So look how special he is. But for whatever reason, he is singled out and portrayed as this figure. And what they do is they draw on very many of the same tropes, on many of the same ideas that have been used to discuss Paoli, that have been used to discuss George Washington, that are now being used to discuss Bonaparte in France, and they apply the same language to Toussaint Louverture. So they see him as charismatic in very much the same way. Again, there's the same idea of him as a celebrity. There's the same interest in his private life. There's a very interesting newspaper article, which I discuss in great detail, published in France in 1798, which describes his life on the plantation he has bought in great detail. And so he too, again, in the book, it was not particularly my interest to show the charismatic authority he had over his own forces, because that was a very different situation where he was really using word of mouth and not using the French language, but using Creole. It was a very different sort of charisma, which is certainly extremely important, but was not part of my concern in the book particularly. I was mostly concerned to show the relationship he had with the educated classes in Saint-Domingue, with the French revolutionaries, and with an educated public across the Atlantic world, all of whom see him in very much the same mold as these other charismatic leaders.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. And regarding Saint-Domingue and Toussaint Louverture, I wanted to ask somewhat more specific question that doesn't directly concern your book, but I'm very interested about the fact that I think in the last 20, 30 years, historiography on revolutions in the era of the Atlantic world has, and correct me if you have another opinion, has increasingly focused, especially I think in Britain, USA and France, on the Haitian slave revolt. Why is so much importance placed on this event in research, to the point that I think a lot of historians consider it as significant, the Haitian Revolution, as significant as the French and the American Revolution?
Well, so that's, again, a very important question. There has been a huge shift. I think, you know, certainly the shift begins with a recognition of an absence. And the absence was the one that about 30 or 40 years ago, there was very, very little attention paid outside of Haiti itself and outside of a few fairly limited circles in France and Britain and the US, there was relatively little attention paid to the Haitian Revolution. And it's quite remarkable that my predecessor at Princeton, Robert Palmer, published a very well-known book in the late 1950s and early 1960s in two volumes called The Age of the Democratic Revolution, which looked at the United States, it looked at France, it looked at the Netherlands, it looked at Poland, it looked at revolutions in Italy, it looked at, you know, the Triennio Giacobino in Italy, it looked at all of this, said nothing about Haiti. And even books that would also mention the Latin American revolutions basically avoided mentioning Haiti. And the great anthropologist Michel Rolf Trouillot wrote a book about called Silencing the Past, which talks about this silencing of the Haitian Revolution, of the ways that because these revolutionaries were Black, because they were formerly enslaved, and because of the enormous violence that necessarily accompanied this revolution, that figures in the West outside of Haiti from the 18th century all the way into the 20th century were not able to recognize the Haitian revolutionaries, as in the sense of having a rational political program, as having, you know, rational and, you know, and reasonable political goals, and so on and so forth. Certainly going back to the 18th century, there was a large-scale tendency to see the Haitian Revolution essentially as a bloody mess, as a revolt that very quickly led to episodes of what would be called savagery, with the massacre of white colonists, ending with the proclamation of Haiti's independence at the beginning of 1804, accompanied itself by a massacre of white colonists. We don't know how extensive that massacre really was, and it certainly followed upon a brutal race war in which the French were trying to, you know, practically exterminate much of the Haitian population. But in any case, because of this, the Haitian Revolution was simply not included. Now, so there was a strong feeling that, yes, it has to be included. We have to pay attention to it. And so that's one reason. And then a second reason was expressed quite eloquently by the historian Laurent Dubois, one of the first, actually American historians, despite his name, to write about the Haitian Revolution and to write about the Caribbean revolutions in the 1990s. And Laurent Dubois said in his book on the Haitian Revolution, he said, well, you know, this is the first revolution where the idea of human rights and of liberty were really taken to their logical, to their logical conclusion. So that the United States had a revolution beginning in 1775 in which the humanity and the liberty of the enslaved population was simply never recognized. And so there was this enormous degree of hypocrisy that accompanied the American Revolution from the beginning, a revolution which proclaimed all men are created equal and kept millions of human beings alive. Same thing for the French Revolution, which did proclaim abolition in February of 1794 throughout the French Empire, but only did so under the pressure of the revolt by the enslaved people themselves. So, again, the sense that if we want to look for really the fullest example of human liberation in the 18th century, we don't look to Philadelphia, we don't look to Paris, but we actually look to Cap-Français, and we look to Port-au-Prince, and we look to Haiti. So I think these are some of the reasons why. Now, of course, the other difficulty here, though, is that the Haitian Revolution, by the time that they actually established the Haitian state was never a democracy. It was more of a democracy in the late 1790s when it was still a French colony. But soon after taking power in 1804, Toussaint's successor, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, declares himself emperor, following the example of Napoleon. He's assassinated. There's then essentially a dictatorial republic in the south of the country. There's a kingdom briefly in the north of the country until 1820. And then the history of the 19th century is a history of repeated coups d'etats, military dictatorships, and so on and so forth. So that is, of course, another reason why the Haitian Revolution was never integrated so much into the history of the Atlantic revolutions. But then again, France did not have exactly a great record with democracy itself in the 19th century.
Yeah, and I will say we still see the consequences of these events that took place in Haiti still today in that island.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would now like to focus on George Washington. Sure. Because, well, we have an American professor, and of all these charismatic leaders, Washington is the one who has fascinated me the most. And my question on this subject is, in your opinion, can we say that among all these five leaders, Washington is the only one who did not obsessively pursue power, unlike, for example, Napoleon. And because I think he demonstrated multiple times with his resignation twice. And despite this respect for the Constitution and for the institutions, and despite the fact that Washington, and you correct me, acted quite differently, at the end of the book, you write that we still cannot consider him a democratic leader, if I'm not wrong.
Oh, I do see him as a democratic leader. I mean, and he's a complicated case. And in some ways, I agree with you. One of the most fascinating cases here among these five figures, he is the only one who did not seize personal power. And that was for many different reasons. Some of the reasons are, in fact, personal. He had a deep commitment to Republican principles, far deeper than any of the other figures. He himself was obsessed from a very early age with the history of the Roman Republic, with the figure of Cato, with the figure of Cincinnatus. He really did not see himself as somebody, as a possible dictator. So that's certainly one reason. Another reason, very important, is that simply that the conditions in the young United States were never pushed to the point where he might have been forced to take power. So there was never a genuine civil war going on. There was conflict with loyalists, but these loyalists were never really in a position to challenge by themselves. With the British Army, it's another question, but the loyalists by themselves were never in a position to challenge the supremacy of the Continental Congress during the American Revolution. So there was not the same... There was never the same necessity for a dictatorship that certainly many people in France perceived, that many people in South America perceived, and in Haiti, and for that matter, to a certain extent, in Corsica. So for these reasons, Washington, never did seize power himself. What's interesting, though, is that certainly many people urged him to do so, and it certainly would have been possible for him to do so. So he would have the degree of acclamation, in fact, that he received from the American population, was absolutely as great as anything shown for Bolivar or for Bonaparte or for Toussaint Louverture. He enjoyed an absolutely incredible popularity. There was the Venezuelan revolutionary Francisco Miranda, who comes to the United States in the late 1780s, early 1790s. He sees George Washington entering Philadelphia and says, "I saw Washington enter, and had this been Christ entering the city, you couldn't, and the Messiah himself, you would not have seen greater devotion to him from the people." And so I think that one could imagine other conditions under which Washington might have been forced to accept a kind of dictatorial role. And one could certainly see the possibility of a person with different political ambitions and a different political character having decided to take power. But in Washington's case, it did not happen.
Okay. And what did Napoleon think of Washington? And can we say that at the beginning of his consulate, of his power, can we say that he wanted to present himself as a French Washington at the beginning, before he then, I will say, transforms more into a Caesar than a Cincinnatus?
So the case of Napoleon and his relationship to Washington is a really fascinating one. Napoleon... I think it's pretty clear that, from the very beginning, even of the French Revolution, Napoleon was somebody who could have seen himself in power as an authoritarian ruler. There's a wonderful letter written by his younger brother, Lucien, to his older brother, Joseph, in the early 1790s, where Lucien says, "We can't trust this guy. He has a really bad character. If he ever were to become a king, he would be a despot," right? I mean, this is well before, this is when Napoleon is still, I think, a lieutenant or a captain in the French army. So it's really quite a remarkable letter. But the fact is that for a very long time, Napoleon has to play the role of a good Republican. So in 1793-94, when he's coming to prominence, he's allied with the young Augustin Robespierre, the younger brother of Maximilien Robespierre. He poses as a radical revolutionary. Then as an army officer coming to glory and to prominence as the leader of the Army of Italy in 1796-97, on the one hand, it's very interesting, when he establishes his own headquarters in the Italian city, town of Mombello, he actually establishes a kind of royal court for himself, and people have to come and sort of pay court to him. He eats dinner in front of an audience, the way that the kings did at Versailles. He has his carriage drawn by a very large number of horses in the manner of a monarch. So he's already showing sort of monarchical tendencies there already in 1797 in Italy. And yet when he comes back to France, he is very careful, because this is still the French Revolution, and people are very suspicious of a Julius Caesar. I mean, the people in the French Republic know what happened to the Roman Republic, and they keep warning about a Caesar. You have to watch out for Caesar. What, you know? And the great hero is the first Junius Brutus, who has had, you know, both Brutuses, the Brutus who overthrows the Tarquins and the Brutus who kills Caesar. So Napoleon always plays the role. He says, "I'm just a civilian. I don't want to. I'm just a humble officer. And while I'm in Paris, I will take off my uniform and be a civilian. I'm always a good Republican." And even when he seizes power in 1799, he is still very careful for the first couple of years to present himself as a good Republican. He knows that public opinion in France is still not really ready for somebody to be a kind of monarchical figure again. And he needs the support of the revolutionary public. So Washington is very convenient for all of this, because Napoleon takes power in November of 1799. 1 month later, Washington dies. And immediately across the United States, there's this enormous outpouring of emotion, of kind of acclamation for Washington. And the French see this. And in early 1800, Napoleon stages a memorial service for Washington at the Invalides in Paris, where he will eventually himself be buried one day. And he gets people to give orations about George Washington, which are also very clearly about him. And these people all praise Washington as the great Republican hero. They draw comparisons between Washington and Bonaparte. But at the same time, if you look at these orations, there's also hints of what is to come, because they say, you know, Washington is somebody who ruled more by affection than by law. So it was more important, the bond with the people, than the legal role that he had as a general and then as president. So that's already pretty indicative of the way Napoleon sees politics. And then they say, you know, and then Washington also realized that things were very much in sort of en ébullition, things were very much in chaos, and that he couldn't always stick to the letter of the law, and he really had to, you know, push his political authority. And that's also, you know, Napoleon sort of already looking ahead to the period of the sort of second consulate that begins in 1802. So already we see some hints there. But for the moment, Napoleon is still mostly using Washington to say, he was the great Republican leader. I will be the Francis Washington. I will be the great Republican leader. A couple of years later, tout change. Everything changes.
And well, before moving to the last question, staying on Washington, because we both mentioned Cincinnato and the society of Cincinnati, which Washington belonged, together with also important French aristocrats. And I also remember, for example, another man on horseback that you don't talk about, but is very interesting, for example, Tadeusz Kościuszko from the Polish independence. And so who is Cincinnato, if you could quickly explain who is Cincinnato and what is the society of Cincinnati?
So Cincinnatus, as Americans would refer to him, was an aristocrat of the Roman Republic back in, you know, several centuries before the Common Era. He was in a moment of peril for the Roman Republic. He took the formal title of dictatore, to save the Roman Republic from threat. But then he was very careful. Once the threat had passed, he relinquished the title of dictator and he relinquished his military command, and he went back to becoming a simple farmer. He went back to his plow. So for Livy and for other Roman historians, Cincinnatus was one of the great figures of the Roman Republic, the great figure of Republican values, the person who put the interest of the common people and the common good above his own personal interest, the person who would, if necessary, take up the complete command, the full powers in order to deal with a threat to the nation, but would then immediately relinquish the full authority as soon as possible and again go back to his plow. So Washington, first in 1783, he resigns his command of the Continental Army. And then, for which actually no less a figure than King George III says, if he really does this, he will be the greatest man in the world. That's what the King of England says at the end of the revolt against England. And then in 1797, after his two terms as president, Washington says, all right, enough, I'm done. I'm going back to, and in both cases, he goes back to Mount Vernon, to his plantation, which is to say, in a sense, going back to being a very wealthy kind of farmer. And so he is immediately hailed as the American Cincinnatus. And early in the history of the American Republic, there are people who try to establish what is called the Society of the Cincinnati as a kind of honor society for people who had a very important role in the American Revolution. But very quickly, there's also there are warnings about what the Society of the Cincinnati could become, so that Mirabeau, in particular, the French revolutionary, writes a very influential letter saying, you can't let this turn into an American nobility. You have to, there's going to be a society that says that it has to be purely honorific. And what's interesting is that Napoleon establishes a kind of equivalent to this in France, which is the Legion of Honor. And in France, the Legion of Honor does become briefly the basis for the Napoleonic nobility. So Napoleon goes in a different direction with it.
Okay, very interesting. So now I will go on with the last question. And I would now like to ask you a question that I believe is very important, especially now, given what will happen in a week in the United States. And the question is, what is the role of charismatic political leaders today in our democratic societies? Because from what I understood by reading for you, charisma, the charisma of political leaders, is something that is potentially dangerous, yet at the same time, potentially strengthening for our societies and institutions.
Well, thank you. That's a great way to finish. And I should first say, again, just as I said a little while ago, that I did not see the 18th century as having invented the phenomenon of political charisma, that there are different historical forms of political charisma. So just as there are differences between older monarchical charisma and revolutionary charisma of the late 18th century, so there are also enormous differences between political charisma of the late 18th century and charisma today. As I tried to emphasize in the book, it depends a great deal on the, on factors such as the media environment, so that, a media environment dominated by newspapers and expensive newspapers in the 18th century is very different from our media environment today, obviously. The existence of political parties makes an enormous difference as well. There were no really established political parties in the countries that I'm talking about at the time that these leaders came to power. So again, with that caveat, I would say, though, that the 18th century does establish something very important in the relationship of political charisma to modern democracy. Because on the one hand, these charismatic figures were all in some ways very important for the establishment of representative regimes, and even for the establishment of democratic regimes to a certain extent in their countries, particularly Washington, obviously. Why is this? Well, because to put it very simply, when you move from a monarchy to a constitutional government, particularly a constitutional republic without a powerful figurehead, what you're doing is you're transferring authority from a person, a figure of flesh and blood whom people can see and they can identify with very easily, and you're transferring authority from that person to a set of rules, to a document, to a set of ideas, to, in other words, to abstractions. You're going from a person to abstractions. And that could be, in the 18th century, something which is actually very difficult for people to deal with and to come to terms with. The idea that you can have, these monarchs served very effectively as unifying figures for their country. People in France in the 18th century were not united by language. They were not united by, they were not united by common laws, which they didn't have. There were a lot of forces of disunity in France at the time, but there was the monarch as a living, breathing center of unity for them, the French monarchy. And then to go from that to saying, well, okay, I believe in the Constitution, I believe in the rights of men, that can be very powerful in certain circumstances, but it's cold and abstract in others. And so these figures were absolutely crucial for providing a figure of flesh and blood, a figure of unity, who could help to bind the people to this new system, to these rules, to these constitutions. It's very important that all these figures were themselves either authors of or in some ways fathers of constitutions. Washington presided over the Constitutional Convention. Bonaparte and Bolivar both wrote their own constitutions. So did Toussaint Louverture. So did Paoli. So they help, in a sense, acclimatize people to a new form of government by providing that figure of flesh and blood and that figure of emotional attachment. So in all these ways, I think charisma has been very important to democracy, and it can still be also very important even today. And there's the French political scientist Jean-Claude Monod, who's written very interestingly about this, that when you have paralysis and when you have stalemate in democratic societies, it can actually help to have a charismatic figure, whether a Kennedy or an Obama, or to actually help break through the stalemate and introduce needed reforms. So in all these ways, political charisma can be very important and helpful for democracy. But then there's the flip side, right? Then there's the other side of the coin. And the other side of the coin is that particularly when the bond with these figures can become very intense, and when you have a movement that supports these figures and actually sees these figures as more important than the law, more important than the Constitution, then it becomes possible for these figures to override the Constitution, to dispense with the Constitution, to stage a coup d'etat, and to transform what had been a constitutional system of rules and of law into something closer to a dictatorship, to authoritarian rule. And in most of these countries, this is exactly what happened. So that Bonaparte seizes power in 1799, Toussaint Louverture writes a constitution in 1800, which essentially makes him, the dictator of Saint-Domingue without any representation really whatsoever. Bolivar literally becomes dictator of Venezuela and of the Republic of Colombia, of Gran Colombia for a time. So, again and again, you actually have this happening in this period. And then throughout the 19th and into the 20th century, obviously in different ways, when you have charismatic figures who use their popularity to seize power, sometimes with the help of political parties, with ideological movements, as in the case of, obviously in the 20th century, sometimes independently, as in the case of somebody like Louis Napoleon Bonaparte in the 19th century. But again, the threat is always there. And as I correctly warn in the book, which was published in 2020, it has obviously been there in the United States since 2016.
Yeah, and sadly, it's always sempre un pericolo, like I would say.
Yes, exactly. Italian. Sempre un pericolo. Esattamente. I mean, already I think it's important to recognize people don't like to admit this in the United States, but if we look at the last century in the United States and we ask who are the most important American political figures, there are really three. There's Franklin Roosevelt, there's Ronald Reagan, and there's Donald Trump. And he has already established that level of historical importance for himself by transforming the Republican Party into a personal vehicle, something which had never been done before in the history of American politics, to transform a major political party into a personal vehicle of this sort, and to break the rules as much as he has done. And for his supporters, and again, one point that I made, I'll finish here, is that charisma is not a kind of objective quality. It always exists in the eyes of the beholder, so that figure can be charismatic to some people and not to others. I am a Democrat. I do not, a member of the Democratic Party. I do not think of Donald Trump has no attraction to me, no magnetism as far as I am concerned, but to his supporters, he is intensely charismatic. And that is what he has used in order to make his political career since 2016.
Yeah, completely agree. So, Professor, thank you very much for this interview. I really enjoyed it, and I found it very interesting. E a tutti quelli che guardano questo video, andate assolutamente a leggere il libro del professor Bell, non solo questo, anche tutti gli altri. Ringrazio ancora il professor Bell e un saluto a tutti, alla prossima.